I wouldn't have suspected that at all. I can't imagine Atlassian thinks they're going to play in that space. I thought they were going after OpenAI's next browser and whatever it may be.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? Adversarial. It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back to podcast time. Good to see you, Sunil. Good to see you, Mario. We got a good bit to talk about this week. I'm just glad we're back on a steady cadence here. We're going to talk about some dev-centric stuff this week and then switch over into board and cyber governance. And so we're really painting the spectrum and dropping a lot of things in the middle of that. Quick personal catch-up. What do you guys got going on? Sunil, just to put you on the spot here, looks like you're home. Good for you. Well, what's new?
Short respite before I travel again for various events. I'll be on the West Coast. Hey, Mario, I'll be on the West Coast next week. So
let's hang out, man. Let's hang out.
Sunil's known to ride a bike.
Oh, Jerry.
Mario's known to not actually ride a bike, but to say he does a lot. So maybe with you, Sunil, he'll feel like, oh, yeah, I'll get out there with this dude.
And to be clear, I ride a bike. I don't cycle.
Oh, okay. That's the problem. That's right. Yeah. Mario, what's up? Glad to see you're holding it down at home.
I'm just glad college football's back and professional football's back, baby. We get to watch some football this weekend.
Yeah. Who's your college team?
Well, I didn't go there, but my wife went there, Penn State. So watching Penn State, looking great, you know, and obviously I root for the Niners as well.
You do? Okay. I have issues. I went to Clemson University and later, now I teach at Georgia Tech, and Clemson is playing against Georgia Tech tomorrow.
Nice.
Yeah, that'll date the recording. So, you know, my kids found out and they're like, oh yeah, we should go. Like, I don't know what to do. Yeah. So it's tough because Georgia Tech is on a good little run, and beating Clemson would just kind of like supercharge them. Get him in the ranking.
My understanding is you always go with the school you got a BA or BS from, man.
That's funny. I don't have a degree from either of those because I then went from Clemson to University of Maryland's distance learning thing and got a BS in legal studies there. So could do that. But then, and it really is a BS in legal studies. It's a weird combo. And then I got a master's degree. Now, this is exciting, though. I got a master's degree, an MBA from Georgia State, the Panthers, who have been coming on strong, both academically and athletically. So they've got a massive stadium here in the city, and I'll be on that bandwagon. Keep your eye out. You'll see a lot about the Panthers, and then you'll think, how many teams are there in Georgia? It'll be frustrating. All right, so getting into it, I think the biggest headline around here has been around this NPM package hijack, mainly because of the ubiquity of the application here. So, I mean, like literally here at our nine-person startup, we have an incident register, right? That's what our product is, so we use it ourselves. And fortunately, there's not a lot of data in there, but we try to dog food it. And there's one in there because Tommy McCormick, shout out, he's plugged into all this stuff and he's tracking it and like, oh, yeah, wow, we had these libraries and so on. And then the rest of the universe all piped in. And it seems like every company has some kind of impact here. I'll quickly recap it and then we'll get into some of the ramifications, but I'll recap it for everyone. And then you guys correct me if I get the recap wrong. A package maintainer was phished, had his with MFA, but he had an MFA reset phish, and they got into his account and they backdoored a number of packages he maintained, which happened to be like greatest hits of Hello World, but of like really rudimentary bits that a lot of people had bundled into a lot of applications. And then, and here's a little hint as to what I want to talk about today. And then due to the fact that that single human being has sole ability to modify and ship production code on millions of companies around the world, despite the big four going through all of them every day to look for segregation of duties, due to that situation, they were able to deploy malware that fortunately just did some address substitution for crypto, and they really bunged that up pretty bad, and they got $1,000 and maybe, we still don't even know for sure, that wasn't like their own test transactions. But the bigger good story wasn't, oh, they only got $1,000 versus getting a lot of money. It was more, they only went after end consumer front end crypto versus the RCE and shells and backdoor and all the stuff that could have led all the other things that could happen to companies. So a lot of things, this isn't the only recent let's target open source contributors, right? There's a lot of that in there. First of all, did I miss anything in the recap?
I forget. Does this guy live in Nebraska? You know, that one open source developer that maintains this critical infrastructure package, you know, if you remember the XKCD.
Oh, yeah. No. Oh, XKCD. I thought you meant the XZ package that had the exact
that
same
too.
Pattern. What was that, 6 months ago? Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, it was a missed opportunity for the attackers. It could have been significantly worse for a lot of us. I mean, we still, if anything, I think it's worthwhile. Well, I don't know if it's worthwhile, but it's occasionally nice to have an event that causes you to scramble to figure out what the impact is, knowing that there wasn't really any impact, but going through the motions of figuring out what the impact could have been, because it really could have been significantly worse.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a really good point. Like, what are companies supposed to do with this news? The kind of easy, just awful CISO thing is, everyone's working all weekend because we're going to track down everywhere where this thing is and rip it out. And right, that's not the problem at all. First of all, due to the fact that the way that the badness manifested, most people could keep it in there forever, and that doesn't really matter. It's tainted meat, but you know what bacteria it has, and it's bacteria uh-huh. You could survive. It's totally the root cause analysis, right? That, like you said, like the what could have been, those tabletop exercises are a massive opportunity that shouldn't be missed at companies.
Right.
So for the average company who says, oh, it's a good thing that they didn't do X, Y, and Z that we know in our platform would be the end of the world for us. And so that company needs to then say, like, okay, wow, that could have happened. That's not acceptable here. What are the controls that they should have put in place?
Yeah, and there's some existing, like, we had controls around the 3-day quarantine or pinning packages so that in the event that...
And that would have worked here. Great.
Yeah. It doesn't always work in all circumstances, and certainly it doesn't work inside of the developer environment itself. But the perspective of at least production code and such, there's some mitigations there. There are a couple other things I thought was nice about this one. One, it was on a Monday-ish, not Friday. So at least at the beginning of the working day.
Amateur.
Yes, exactly. These amateurs, they didn't quite know how to make our lives more miserable. So that's one. Two, the MPO ecosystem is, like, the dependency, it's truly dependency hell, right? There's so many points of entry here. The attack surface is massive. And it's just because of the way the JavaScript, you know, it's just because of the way the JavaScript and the whole ecosystem came about. I'm not sure if this is a thing that we can necessarily fix. We just have to live with the predicament that we're in and be able to show that we can reactively address any issues that emerge. This will happen again, no doubt. And having the muscle memory to respond quickly is something that people are going to have to rely upon again.
Why do you think, the thing that impressed me the most, given the amateur hour on some of these folks who did this, but the way the community reacted so quickly, I had read in days. I mean, is it just because of that particular usage of this product being that important, that open source package? Or are we learning something from this? Is the community getting better at reacting quicker? I'm trying to look for the good news here.
Yeah.
Well, I think the maintainer, first of all, came out and said, hey, I got fished. Like, I just got fished. I need help. And because of that, action was taken pretty quickly, and the attacker really only had a really small window. There's others who get compromised and they don't realize it or are too embarrassed, you know, whatever. But this guy was like, hey, problem.
Yeah.
And we were able to react.
Kudos to him. That's awesome. Yeah. That's kudos to him. I mean, that's the most important thing, I think, in most incident response And whatever training you do, and we've talked about training ad nauseam in this podcast, but whatever training we do for incident response, the most important thing, I think, is when you do know you have been potentially impacted or breached or compromised, contact your security team as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, you need some implied amnesty culturally. You can't slap people on the hand, and you don't get the chance to exercise that on the big one very often, but you do it in the little ones, right? In the, I clicked this link, nothing really happened. You can't belittle people and shame them, or they will just clam up. And then when the big one comes, they're not fessing up, right?
That was rule number one. You gave him kudos. Yeah, you made a mistake, but you immediately realized you made a mistake and you immediately contacted security. Kudos to you. That's going to happen to everyone. So we always, and I want to say always, well, maybe we, most of the time, I don't recall not doing this, but most of the time we said kudos to the person who notifies. I mean, we didn't name who it was when we made this announcement in the company, but we simply said kudos to the person for contacting us almost immediately after the fact.
We had a cool way of doing that. Totally agree. And I think we're in the minority on that, by the way, Mario. Like most people are just kind of like in the security enclave, rolling their eyes at everybody. And so like culturally, we would say, we have a lot of things that are a responsibility of security, but your job, your performance monitoring isn't one of those, and productivity monitoring. People have their own supervisors. As long as they're here, assume that they're doing something really good to get you a bonus every year and don't mock them, right? But in the incident system, and this was like what drove me to build an incident management platform was in that we have tags on every incident. And it's the type of the field is an employee. So imagine you have a Dropbox and you have your employee directory in there. And it was, and I've changed these terms a million times over, but it's contributor and detractor, right? So like who contributed positively or negative to an incident.
Ooh. I never did this. This is interesting.
Well, it's cool. It's like everybody wants something quantitative in security. And yeah. It's always hard and it's forced a lot of times. But this works. So first of all, you have to have a severity rubric that you stick to, right? And a Sev 1 is the end of the world and a Sev 5 is a nothing burger and then whatever. Use whatever, but it just has to be clear and unequivocal what makes each category. And then what we would do is when we were measuring the vigilance of an employee, we'd have different elements, like four different elements that were in there. And it included, did they do security awareness training, phish testing, and that kind of thing. But one of them was positive and negative contributions to incidents. And if you were and it was easy to find the negative person, right? Because in the phish or whatever it was, the person who clicked the link had a negative score. But then you could have people that were positive, and we'd amplify that by the severity of the incident. So if you were the one who brought down the whole company, that's really bad. That's Sev 1 on you. But if you self-reported, you're also the positive and they could wash out. Right?
Wow.
But usually the positive was the SRE that said, oh, I know how to get those logs, those types of people, which is totally separate and another cool way to like provide some kudos to people.
Yeah. And there's a thing called the near misses database within the aviation industry. NASA actually maintains this near misses database, which is basically, it's a self-reporting mechanism amongst pilots to say, hey, there was some issue and it was a near miss. It could have gone south, could have gone bad, but it didn't. And I'm going to self-report that. And there is a mechanism within that reporting scheme that says if later on you or somebody's related to that event, there's some issue that emerges that requires some sort of disciplinary action, the fact that you reported it proactively is counted very much in your favor. And so it's very similar to what you're describing. And there exists a nice precedent in the aviation industry just for that.
And yeah. has it turned out to be positive, Sunil? I mean,
it sounds like it, right?
I mean, right?
Well, and what we learn, of course, is like all these near misses and why they happen, and it gives the aviation industry a way to quickly learn and share best practices to avoid that in the future.
Yeah, it only makes sense. Well, so back to, like, if you don't mind, let me go back to my snide snippet that was in here, right? So we all have been around long enough that we, first of all, know that audit, and by audit, I mean from bit site to regulatory examiners to your literal internal law department, like anybody who's in that challenge capacity will generally gravitate towards things that are easy to audit, right? Or that are possible to audit, right? That's why everybody cares about TLS cipher support, right? Just because you can find it publicly. It's not important, completely uninteresting, but someone could write a quick script to measure it, and then we have this whole bit site industry, you know, based on that. Auditors thus love, like, policies, right? You write the policy, you after you've gone through a few rounds, you just know as you're writing policy nowadays, you're like, uh-oh, what are the auditors going to do? How are they going to sample? How are they going to test? Are we actually going to pass this? I don't want to write something that we don't really do. So one of the things that auditors really jammed onto when it came to, so like IT general control audit, right? That was kind of the predecessor of all the cyber audits, I'd say. Really took on a lot more prominence in 2001 with Sarbanes-Oxley. And that's still here. And that's the, I'm an auditor, I'm a CPA, and I'm supposed to do something about IT. Here's a checklist. In that, segregation of duties is massive. And I remember, you know, going to the mats repeatedly with PwC and others over, well, you're saying this DBA has access, but they write stored procedures. And so technically they're a developer, and you can't have a developer have access to the prod, right? In the old school Fortune 500 world, everyone still thinks that developers can't have access to production. They still tell everyone the developers don't have access to production.
What? Developers have access to production?
No, no. Shocking. Of course not. Of
Stop
course
it.
Not.
Stop
no,
eating.
No, no. There's no need for that, right? And then as far as, like, single point of failure, code peer reviews, right? It's in all the audits. It's asserted that whenever someone writes code, that it's reviewed by a peer before, and you know, and it's approved before the PR is actually committed. And, you know, over and over again, we all assert that. And that's the minimal acceptable standard. Like, the idea that a human being could write code and get it into production is anathema. To say, I would just, if somebody said that and wasn't willing to erase it, they could not pass a SOC 2, like, full stop. And we just showed how many companies on the planet are lying about that. I mean, not only could someone write code, it goes into prod, but it's not even one of their employees. It's, I mean, forget about this guy getting fished. What if he just didn't like you, right? It's a single point of, so back to, like, Sunil was saying, like, it sucks, but it's here to stay. Why not have M of N maintainers required to approve something before it can get pulled? Why not have repos kind of assert whether or not they're compliant with those and actually be able to see, you know, in the metadata, this is one that requires 2 out of 3 people. And then in DevOps, being able to say, like, we won't include anything that doesn't adhere to that standard. Is that insane? Is that possible? Is there precedent for that?
Well, I'll answer before Sunil answers on this one, because I went through this with GitHub, and I am going to pick on GitHub today. Now, they don't do this anymore. I think they've gotten better. But 2-3 years ago, let's say Sunil, Jerry, and Mario have access to this GitHub repo. They work for the same company. So we both successfully logged in. We use whatever technology to authenticate. Okay, so we're there. We're the right person. But once you're using GitHub, I can change my name from Mario to Jerry as the committer. And there's no way of auditing that. There was no log trail in GitHub for that. This is fact, folks, because my red team did this to us 101 different ways.
Wow. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Yeah, I totally see how that would happen and how it would be really confusing.
So your point of having 3 people to approve it, well, if you can change yourself different names and approve it, that goes out the door.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking multiple people with maintainer privilege, right, and unique accounts. And
yep. Yeah.
Well, you can always force people to use a corporate GitHub account, not a personal GitHub account, but that kind of kills the developer vibe, right?
Oh, I had to do that. We had to do that. We had to go. And that was an awful, painful experience. And people hated it.
When can't force and be confident about MFA and about SSO unless you do that. So I think we're all coming on. So back to my idea that fell on deaf ears. Neither of you rushed away to create a startup somehow that would profit off of that. But if the vibe is the problem and the dude in Nebraska's trying to just commit some code and bless his heart for even contributing to, you know, CAT or whatever it is, and so we don't want to put any more friction on him, why not have an AI bot be that second approver? It could also actually look for malware inserted in the code.
Well, certainly, I think with more vibe coded software, we're going to have an increasing amount of code that has to be reviewed, and we're going to need to have AI assistants to help us do that code review as well. At some point, yes, you can imagine a scenario where you have AI assistants creating the code and AI assistants also reviewing the code, hopefully two different AI assistants. But that said, I think the problem that you're also referring to, they manifest in a couple of different places. They manifest on the developer workstation. They manifest in the pipeline. They manifest in production, and you know all these different places along the journey. I think in the context of the recent NPM breach, frankly, for me, the bigger concern wasn't so much in production as much as was on the developer environment. And I recall a Wiz stat that said, during that time that it occurred, about one in ten production applications, they found instances of the compromised code in 1 in 10 production applications.
Yeah.
But I can imagine something much greater in the developer environment. Okay. Just because if you were developing at, if you did anything with NPM during that time, the probability of you having downloaded some of that code would have been pretty high. Whether it would have gone committed into production, you know, there's many other processes in between, including the gates that you're talking about, Jerry. But on the developer side, it just doesn't make sense for you to have a two-party sort of check before a developer pulls that code down.
You know, I want to bring it back to our soapbox with this whole security questionnaire, just to kind of bring it back to the initial, you know, when you ask these security questions by auditors, and how sometimes they can be unuseful. And I'm saying that. Sometimes they can be unuseful. So I'm completing a security questionnaire. And one of the things that I replied back was, we are going to begin our SOC 2 initiative once our MVP is released. You can't do a SOC 2 necessarily if you don't have some environment to run a SOC 2 against, right? I mean, it's pretty basic. And right. and what's frustrating is you provide copious notes and answers only to receive an email back two days later from the auditor for that company telling us, you need to provide us with a SOC 2 report. Can you please include it? So do you ever read my question? Do you ever read my answers? So basically the person, you know, they ask these questions, but apparently they don't even read it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a mess out there.
It's kabuki theater, man. It's kabuki security theater.
It is. I mean, look, one of the things I was like trying to very clearly point out is that every company in the world has promised under pain of death that they have segregation of duties and developers can't push to prod. And we just created a list of companies that we know are lying. All of them are lying. But
yeah,
we know empirically without a doubt that that's just not valid. And if you then went on and said, like, also SAST, like the people who are selling SAST and the people that are buying SAST at the high end, they don't think there's a carve out for open source software. There is. No one's SASTing the code of the open source software. They're SCAing it. Like, is it known to have an issue that a major compromise? Nope. Okay, cool. But did I actually go through like the encoding and see that what it's doing is noble? No, but the CFO thinks that they do. And once again, we've proven nobody's scanning it, right? Because this didn't light up because someone's sneak said, there's this weird crypto thing in the middle of the code. Like, that is not how this discovery started. So during the incidents, we all act like it's okay and nobody does anything. But at the questionnaire time, everybody's beating their chest about how everything is perfect. They sassed everything. They dassed it. They don't include any code without three-party review. And It's an awful shame, and it's insincere.
I can be pretty confident in saying that every company that's been breached has been SOC 2 compliant.
Yeah, exactly. All righty. Switching gears quite a bit. So, and I like to go from the tech stuff to the whatever it may be, but in this case, kind of capital markets and whatnot. So, neat little story here. It wasn't the main headline. Atlassian is buying Arc, I think it is, a browser, or at least that's the name of the browser, if not the company, buying a browser company. And there's an article out there about, are they doing this to go after what I'll just call agentic browsers, or are they doing it to go after the enterprise browser market, which was an angle I never saw coming at all, like meaning go after Island and Talon. I wouldn't have suspected that at all. I can't imagine Atlassian thinks they're going to play in that space. I thought they were going after you know, OpenAI's next browser and whatever it may be. Where do you think that that's going, and or is it either of those or neither of those? What do you think the strategy is here?
My guess is that it's actually neither of those. They're going after the RPA market, or the RDA market, the remote desktop automation market, which is you have a lot of things that you just interact with on the web, and you want to automate as much of that as possible. And one of the best ways to, of course, do that is to have a browser that you can then own and control and people would use, and you monitor that those interactions. And through that, you understand what processes can be automated.
Wait a minute. This is crazy what you just said. Atlassian owns Jira and Confluence, right? That's just some of their biggest products, right? So are you saying they're going to automate some of like a Jira ticket? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
You can say that. So they a while back they had the thing, something called Atlassian Intelligence. I think it turned into this thing called Rovo. But they are absolutely trying to become an AI company with a ton of corporate content that they could use to understand business processes. Wow. So think about what Jira is. What is Jira? Right? It's a workflow tool. It's something that helps us capture our workflow and business processes and such. And so that's how I would see it play out.
And then, wow, I never even thought about this. With the Confluence angle, if somebody did write some specs about the environment, let's say they actually went through the specs, they actually wrote it to engineers and the requirements. And so now you have the Jira cases for whatever thing you're going to do. You can marry both of them. You can use AI to automate a lot of stuff, make it more actionable and less impactful, because it can read the docs before you make a deployment. You see what I'm saying? Is that how you're thinking about it?
Well, some of that. I mean, I do see, like, for example, companies that are helping us do secure design reviews of your applications, and they suck up all your Atlassian data, whether it's your tickets or your Confluence documents or your Drive documents, whatever. So I see that too. But I think the general point I was making is, consider the companies that really help us manage our workflows, right? Ticketing systems. I mean, I wouldn't be too surprised if ServiceNow wanted to try to do something like this too.
Yes.
The companies that sit at the center of business workflows, would it make sense for them to own some part of the browser channel, so to speak, to be able to say, you know, that workflow that you currently put into ServiceNow or into Jira, what if we actually were to help you just execute that workflow automatically or extend the execution of that more beyond just putting in a ticket? What if I can actually help you action that ticket?
Yeah. You know, I took it a different angle. So my thing was that, but I think your point is, again, interesting. I didn't think about it. What I thought was there's a lot of secrets, passwords that are, you know, put in Confluence documentation. And as an attacker, once you gain access to a Confluence, a company's Confluence site, you can start browsing through their docs to figure out the environment. You also try to figure out about if there's any passwords in there. And so I was thinking maybe they're trying to use this, you know, corporate enterprise browser to only allow their users, you know, to access through this secure browser. And two, if they wanted to do a screen capture or if they wanted to do face something, if you're using this browser, it could potentially block it. So I was thinking more about the content that you may find in Jira and Confluence and using these browsers to protect that information.
Right. And so I'm an Island user as well as as a advisor to Island as well. So full disclosure on that. One of the things that I've set up on some of our SaaS websites is to say you can only access this via Island. And this is not because of training or whatever else it is, but because, of course, I just want to keep my corporate data within my own corporate environment.
Correct.
So imagine that being that same sort of policy being taken further and further, but instead of Atlassian saying, hey, bound it within the island universe, we like for you to bound it within the Arc universe instead.
Yep.
Right. Now, here, I think we're going to run into a problem here because if I have to use the Arc browser to access Jira content, but I'm an island user, there's going to be a problem here, right? I'm not going to, and that doesn't make sense that that Atlassian would force you to use an Arc browser. They would instantly lose hundreds, 99% of their customers if they did that.
Unless they do an Arc extension, Sunil, and they can be using islands on Arc extension.
I suppose. Sure, you can put an Arc extension within island, but why bother? It's just kind of a silly overlay.
Yeah.
But anyway, I see reasons why they would want to create this sort of their own island, so to speak. But I think the more interesting play is the whole process element.
Well, I think there's a good metaphor for this out of the financial services industry. And right in the exchange space, the front end and back end were very separated. And I think that's the fear here is that everybody's running a SaaS service. With the advent of AI and MCPs, that the back end will become commoditized. And if Salesforce is just a database that you could query without any workflow and UI that people are all married to and used to and had at their last job, then the front ends become wide open, right? It's whatever people are working in locally, API level. And then not only does it lower the switching cost, but I mean, you could even automate switching. Like at that point, you could even just like in the exchange space, you know about the big stock exchanges and there's a very finite number of exchanges around any product and any vertical. And then the front ends come and go. But like there had to be a federal mandate to create a system that required people to route orders to the best price. Right. So when a broker submits an order right now, it can go to NASDAQ or NYSE or any of the other 11 or 12. And by law, the way this SIP is what it's called, works, it has to route it to the best price. So that's a really bad outcome for Salesforce, if we get to the point where, you have five different CRMs and you've got some cool agent in the middle that's dynamically deciding, and at some point who's going to win that? It's going to be like Postgres, because the less features you're getting out of that, the more CRM just becomes Postgres. So I could see wanting to get ahead of that, but to play that analogy out, think of Bloomberg, right? So on the front ends, we call them ISVs, independent software vendors. As generic as that was, this is a place where you could use those terms and make it a proper noun, independent software vendor. But it basically just meant the UIs, the front-end vendors. And there's this long tail because most of trading is done algorithmically, just like agentic back in the day, high-frequency trading. That's where most of the order flow comes from. And for the few dinosaurs that are actually using UIs, and that's a purposeful joking dig at brokers, but they're using a number of different ones, and Bloomberg has really owned that front end for so long. And everybody in business who's aware of it says, that's a good place to be if you end up becoming like Bloomberg. So maybe part of this is saying, we know it won't last forever, but if we could become the exchange who bought Bloomberg and you couldn't access the exchange's data and tickers and whatever it may be, unless you're using Bloomberg or the Bloomberg plugin, to Mario's point, that's like $1,800 a pop per month, per person. There's a ton of money, so maybe that's the play.
Mm-hmm.
There's another, it's somewhat ancillary, but related to what you're saying that I think disrupts that particular play. So this emerged in Spotify. I'm not a Spotify listener, but the rest of my family is. And I think towards the end of the year, you get this thing called Wrapped, which tells you like how many songs you listen throughout the year or whatever.
Children love that. They love that at the end of the year.
Yeah, mine is usually like zero, right? I don't have any songs that I listen to. But that's it. It's an interesting stat, and Spotify provides that as a service of sorts. But it doesn't really mix it much for you. So there was a service called Unwrapped where you could, as a Spotify user, I believe, basically export your data and send it to somebody else, and they will process it for you. Moreover, if other people wanted to buy that data from Unwrapped, you would get a portion of you would be paid some portion of that data that you just basically sold. Okay.
And does that mean like if they want to listen to your playlist, or are you talking about like marketers want to analyze your listening?
The latter. Okay. If some marketer wanted to buy that Unwrapped data that you now provide, then you benefit from that. You get paid out as a user. So instead of Spotify benefiting from it, you actually directly benefit in selling to some other marketer. And presumably the marketer pays a much lower premium than having paid Spotify directly. Anyway, as you may imagine, Spotify is not too happy about that. But if you have any sort of a feature that lets you export your data and have it be processed by some other front-end entity, then we're starting to really disrupt those who've put a gate on that sort of processing, maybe on the back end. Bottom line is that the front end is becoming more and more scrapable, if not just purely because people allow you to port your data to other places. But now we have a place to put it and potentially to monetize it ourselves.
Yeah, and all these browsers, including Arc, if I'm remembering correctly, are Chromium-based.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like if you're going to just tear it to pieces and rebuild it in the way you want, then it seems kind of weird to buy one, and unless it's just like at cost, so to speak, the sale. But it's kind of hard to imagine. If you don't want the actual existing market and you just want the technology, then there's a lot of humans out there that have built a browser off Chromium these days. And you can hire. Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of software engineering, Sunil, you're excited as the former chief cybersecurity innovation or scientist. Well, give me your title. I know you're humble, but.
Chief security scientist.
So you're security scientist at Bank of America for a while.
Yeah.
So this is kind of your bailiwick here. So I'm not surprised that you, if anybody, is taking note on this. Well, we'll talk about this Apple announcement about how they're changing some security paradigms on mobile. This is just iOS?
Well, it's not just iOS, but actually very specifically iPhone 17. So Apple, as a part of their announcement of the new iPhone 17 devices, released a security capability that they call memory integrity enforcement, or MIE, that significantly reduces the attack surfaces associated with memory-based attacks. And the memory, memory safety and memory-based attacks are still, or it's just, it's a common curse of software where they continue to still pervade or the source of many vulnerabilities that we see out there in the wild. And as you may imagine, everyone knows, of course, that iPhones are probably among the most targeted devices out there. And their bug bindings are pretty significant. I think up to $1 million or $1.5 million or $2 million, I think. I forget. Somewhere in that range, right? Pretty significant to find a zero-click kernel-level persistent vulnerability. And these vulnerabilities are usually found through memory exploiting or interacting with memory in unsafe ways. So, okay, all that said, there was a standard that was created a few years ago called memory tagging extensions. It's a way to, at the hardware level, to tag... create random tags towards a memory space. Anyway, Apple started playing around with it, and so did, by the way, Android and Chrome, the Chrome team. They've started to play with it, but Apple found some issues with the MTE, memory tagging extension, specification. So they added some additional enhancements, this is the part that I found most remarkable. And I'm going to semi-quote this from the release that Apple had. So they spent to make this all work, to support memory integrity enforcement, they dedicated an extraordinary amount of Apple Silicon resources to security, more than ever before. And this included CPU area, CPU speed, memory for tag storage. This is a significant hardware investment that they're making. And this is just for security. And I was just really happy to hear that, right? That they're actually putting this amount of effort into security. And in doing so, they've really moved the needle forward in creating an architecture and design that is, that so far, well, I mean, just upon the reading of it, seems to be highly, highly resilient to a number of different types of attacks or finding exploits against, or memory-based exploits against against the this type of architecture. The key point here is that it's tied to the hardware. So it right now, this only works on the app. The more robust features work only on iPhone 17. They're trying to backport as much as they can to the older devices, but it is really tied at the hardware level. It's not something that will be immediately available to everyone just because you need these hardware level checks. But it is exciting. And there's one other thing that I thought was even more interesting from a standpoint of driving businesses towards this. So they were able to actually solve one of the longstanding problems with respect to speculative execution. So if you all remember the Spectre Meltdown attack from way back when,
yep.
Fixing that was actually really hard because speculative execution improved the speed of the CPUs. But they found a way to introduce this design in such a way that it didn't actually have the same cost. It basically arrived at basically zero CPU cost to limit the reach of these speculative attacks. And so it means that something that we've actually struggled to fix for a while has now been not completely fixed, but makes it harder for the attacker to exploit. There's still ways to exploit it, but you know, it's just made it much, much, much harder than before.
Is this only, you keep mentioning iPhone 17, but mm-hmm. is this also applicable to Macs?
Yeah, so what Apple intends to do is to introduce the same level of hardware improvements to Macs, but the current Macs that you have today won't have it supported at the same level that you'll have for the iPhones, for the iPhone 17.
My take on this, I certainly appreciate it, the computer science of it, but am I wrong that, like, for the listening CISOs or your CIOs or certainly lay folks, this is like a nothing to do with them? I mean, like, the incidents from the past that this would have thwarted are like six people in the Middle East. No one that I know, okay, whether or not they say otherwise, has ever had their iPhone compromised.
Yes and no. So you're correct that this addresses these extraordinarily edge cases, right? But the more exciting aspect of this is you now have they've now published this design, and this design is extraordinarily robust against these types of attacks. And so it's a significant uplift in terms of offering a design that ensures a degree of memory safety and makes it really hard to exploit these type of systems. So consider now, we have all these. When's the last time we had a Fortinet vulnerability? When's the last time we had a Citrix NetScaler, you know, vulnerability?
Between recording and when we go publish.
Yeah.
That's your answer.
And how many of them are because of, you know, buffer overflow, stupid memory issues, right?
Yeah, okay.
Many of them are due to stupid memory issues. Now, will they be able to take advantage of this technology at the fullest possible level? The answer is no, because the hardware level, it's not supported at the hardware level. But I can imagine, let's say, a year from now, where you have a next generation of this type of hardware, where it has these features built in, and now finding those vulnerabilities will be extraordinary. I mean, just out of the box, the finding those vulnerabilities will become much harder. Will there be easy ways to break into those from besides buffer, in the memory attacks and such? Sure, but this is a like this removes a significant portion of the attack.
It's a watershed moment in your mind.
But you know, like I'm in Jerry's camp, Sunil, and when we first talked about this before our podcast, when we were looking at this stuff, I kind of had this, you know, kind of deer in the headlight look, like, what the fuck is this? Why do I care about it? Right? I mean, how is this going to secure my... and you were totally excited because you were geeking out on the technologist.
Sorry, that's why I did the title call out, Sunil.
Right? Sunil's like totally geeking out on tech. I'm like, yeah, and that was Jerry. I'm like, okay, well, there's maybe 9-10 people in the world, I'm making it up, that can actually exploit this. But I go back to the money. Yes, Apple did invest a lot of money. They put a lot of resources to make this. Yes.
Well, okay, but this is why I mentioned this the Spectre issue, right? The part of the reason why some of these some of the controls that we wanted to put in was because they can't turn off speculative execution. It would have been disastrous from a CPU computation, you know, from being competitive in terms of having CPUs operate at the speed that they sell it at. Because they've been able to fix it through this, it actually now creates a reason to say, oh, you know what? We should upgrade to this new architecture. And I think that's actually one of the, personally, I think it would be one of the nicer drivers. Because at the end of the day, we actually still want to fix the Spectre.
No, totally. No, but correct me if I'm wrong. Spectre wasn't just an Apple thing. It was all over.
Exactly.
Yeah, correct. So are you saying that they're going to sell this framework to other companies? Is that where the money's? I always have to look at the money.
Oh, no, no.
Jerry. I always got to look at the money, man.
Sorry, this isn't an Apple selling the architecture. This is Apple saying, hey, we worked on this and created this new architecture, and everyone should adopt something like this.
To me, this is the next maintaining the whatever moat they had on Apple Store and on secure apps. Like, as a security practitioner, I would tell people, iOS is more secure than Android, to tell lay people.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if I'm going to wake up with a horse's head in my bed, but it totally is, because how many times did you in Threat Intel monitoring get notifications about rogue malware versions of your apps? And you're like, oh, is it in the iOS? Is it in the Apple Store? Like, no, of course not. That can't happen. It's in this random site in China. Like, well, who gives a damn? Oh, Android users sometimes download things from random sites in China from there. Like, what?
So, Jerry, are you trying to tell me? This reminds me of like a conversation I had with a CEO of mine 10 years ago. Or we see CISOs regularly get asked this question. Which was more secure, PCs or Macs?
Yeah.
Right. Is this what we're talking about? Is this basically it?
So, yeah, I think so.
So first of all, the MTE the memory tagging extensions is a standard that it's an industry standard. So it's not just Apple. Yeah. And it was actually initially like Google made some of the biggest steps towards making it, putting it to an actual implementation into Chrome, into Pixel. They spent time trying to make this a real thing, but Apple figured out, offered, a slightly enhanced version of that, which I fully would expect others to start adopting and using as well. Again, it requires hardware level. It requires a refresh on the hardware for to get the full set of features. But even without the refresh hardware, there's a lot of things that the enhanced memory tagging extensions that Apple came up with will still apply. Will be able to be backported to older hardware.
Jerry brought it all together for me now in a very simplistic way. Now, here's my iPhone. It's more secure than your Android. I can sell that. I can sell that. I can see that. I'm with you. Okay,
so you're just saying Apple's not doing this for the fun of it, and you were trying to get to the bottom of it.
No, okay. None of these companies. Come on, people. None of these companies doing it for the fun of it. Come on, all right?
Altruism.
There are pet projects out there. We all have skunk works. I get it. I've heard about Google and everybody else. But the reality is you're in it to make money. You're in it to make money for your investors.
Sure. At for this present time, Apple can probably legitimately say they are the most secure device in the world today.
That's the headline. There's the money ball right there.
Yeah. But, to me,
at least iPhone 17.
Yeah, that's right.
There you go. That's right. That's right.
But like, the reason I'm bringing it up is sometimes, I mean, vendors are really guilty of this, but also I think just like practitioners, we get excited about something and then we kind of throw money at it, and then the whole market is like, oh, this is the answer. This is going to solve cybersecurity, and everybody kind of over-indexes and runs to that side of the boat. And on not just memory management, but on software, no less, third-party software, because that's what this is. From a corporate perspective, an Apple, an iPhone is a third-party manufacturer, right? You're trusting them and so on. And all of that is not the big issue for the majority of companies. Like, where this would manifest, once it goes to macOS, for example, would be a couple of major updates that you need to deploy to your fleet, or else what? If an employee is phished and they deliver an executable or trick them into downloading it and installing it and it targets the CVE, then due to memory mismanagement, it can escalate privilege, which even that's over and done. I mean, who wants to be that stupid root user? They don't have a Salesforce login. I want to be the, you know, SU, Sunil. I just realized your initials are SD. This is so effed up. I want to be M. Duarte. Oh my God, Sunil, you just tricked me. All right, I want to be not SU. I want to be M. Duarte because he's the guy who has the login to all the money and the data. I don't want to be a stupid admin anymore. So, I mean, I just think, and even more so, and that's like talking to what is the priority of solving vendor-related security problems and memory management. But then I think we've convinced the world that all of your internal software engineering shops are where security is and where it's done and where all the investment needs to be made. And memory management issues in non-shrink-wrapped apps and, like, internal things, yeah, that's how the dark army or the CIA is going to get in if they really need to for some reason one day.
Yeah.
But otherwise, that's just not manifesting day to day.
Yeah.
Work on your Amazon config, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's what you need to do.
I get it. I mean, the $15 wrench that you can buy at Home Depot will get a password faster than any Chrome computer that you can wait for, right?
I already see my father-in-law giving me a call next week or 2 weeks from now when this news changes from the very geeky information that Sunil has given us to the layman's person, and he's going to call me and I think I should go get an Apple 17 because, you know, I don't want to be compromised.
Right.
This is the most secure private thing I want to do. Got it. You're right, Sunil. I bow down, but I got to hand it to Jerry. He brought the money bowl together for me.
The correct answer to the father-in-law is like, hey, Pop, I also don't want you to get compromised. What you need to do is to stop smuggling trade secrets in a personally crafted submarine to Venezuela every week. Like, you need to stop doing that because those are the people that might get targeted with this.
No, you just get a VPN. Go hire
one. Oh my God, don't
VPN
even joke about it. People are going to take you seriously.
Especially the ones that are free. Come on, Pop. Do that.
Oh no. Yeah, it's an uphill battle being a son-in-law. All right. Thanks for that, Sunil. You really brought some light to that, and I really appreciate it. And kept Mario and I from looking any dumber, but, you know, at the end of the day. Switching gears dramatically, Qantas had this neat little news story where they released in I think it was an annual report actually, but basically like the corporate action statement that said that they had docked some executive pay in recognition of a cyber incident. And it was, you know, all executive pay, not all, but most executive pay has some discretionary components to it. And a lot of times there's a piece of it that's tied to company performance and a piece that's tied to individual performance. But in this case, they said, we're going to haircut pay. It came out to 250 grand, I think Australian, for the CEO and 550 for the other execs that were affected by this, excluding the CEO. And yes, those were relatively de minimis numbers in light of the entire bonus packages. And I think that the entire mark for the company was high as well. So they still ended up doing better than the year before. But that doesn't matter. I mean, I've haircutted bonuses on, you know, important staff, and they do not like precedent. Right? Because they're like, yeah, it's not a big deal now, but I don't want to say that it's okay, because then what's going to happen, you know, with the next leaders of the company or next board or whatever it's going to be. And so I think this is a bit of a milestone that it happened. I think it's sending some good messages here that it's real. What I couldn't find in my digging was whether the chief information security officer or person with whom the buck stops in security was affected by this or not. And I would think it should. I would think if we're going to play this game and say, like, your compensation is tied to our security and incidents or lack thereof, I would think that the chief cyber exec would have to be included in that or not. What do you think about this whole precedent in general and then my twist on it?
All right. So specifics, 15% was the cut. That equated to $250K for the CEO. When you consider the bigger total compensation package, it equated to about 1% of the overall cut. Mm-hmm. But, you know, from a short-term compensation standpoint, $250K is not chump change for most people. One other data point that's meaningful to be aware of is that this was not a breach of Qantas, but rather a breach of Salesforce and the Salesforce data that Qantas data that was in Salesforce, which resulted in many customer records being lost and so on and so forth. So the issue was actually a Salesforce issue. And it's the same group, the shiny hunters folks that are going around hitting a lot of folks through the Salesloft Drift application as well. Okay, so with that in mind, especially with that context, it was a third-party breach. It was a breach against Salesforce. You could argue there's debate about how much control Qantas or any of these companies would have in the context of that type of scenario. So is it warranted? Is a 15% salary cut warranted given that it was... they could, I mean,
out
I
of
guess
their hands.
Yeah, it was largely out of their hands. They could have patched everything.
Which, by the way, is not what security people should be focused on. But
exactly.
Well, and by the way, just to clarify, and I could totally off on this, but I think from what I read about, it was CRM data, so I'm assuming Salesforce. But it was vishing, I think, but social engineering on a call center staff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which then led to it. So in theory, if they had asked them enough questionnaires, and that's a joke, but if they had secured the supply chain, if you will, they may have said, hey, this relationship with this vendor could lead to loss of customer data because they have access to CRM, where all of our customer data is. And therefore, we should check them against some of the common kill chains that do that. So how resilient are you, call center, to vishing? Do you have multi-factor in there? Are we limiting the amount of access you have? And are we throttling and detecting when you suddenly query more than 7 million records in one go? They could have asked that.
Yeah. So again, this is, let me give you more details on the nature of this attack. And this is clever, but MFA wouldn't have helped at all. So,
no.
That wasn't the actual issue. So the flaw, the underlying design flaw, if you will, and I'm not sure if it's even a design flaw, it's a design feature, is what's called like device authentication flow, or if you wanted to activate a separate device, they have this sort of bypass that lets you quickly and easily add another device to your account. So imagine, if you will, you get a call, you get a, we all get the messages when you get a 2FA code. It says, hey, do not ever share this code with anybody else, right? Do not share. You get a code and
don't put it on Instagram.
Don't share with anybody. If someone calls you and asking for this code, don't share this code. Okay. That's what we know. What if instead the attacker says, hey, here's your code. Now put it into this page. Okay. The page happens to be a device activation page. And here's the code. Now, you go into the device activation page, and you go into that page, and because you're logged in, it says, okay, what's the code? Well, you put in the code, and now the attacker has owned your organization. And it's that simple. And that was that's stupidly simple. But that's the whole idea, that if you are a legitimate user trying to bind your Apple TV device to your Apple account, and you don't want to punch in a long password, then you just punch in the 6-digit code and boom, you're hooked in. And this is not just in Salesforce. This is GitHub. This is Microsoft. This is Zoom. This is Discord. The whole device code flow is pretty prevalent. It's in a lot of different places. And it's so easy. I mean, as I was looking at the nature of the attack, I'm like, I could see a lot of us security people falling for this.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe only one out of 10 times, but that's enough.
It was on the 15%. Was that target it to that particular group within the company, or was it across the board for all the executives?
No, it was just to the executives, the CEOs and the executives. And to
I think
Jerry's
the CEO
point.
Had a disproportionately higher haircut.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, we don't know if the CISO also got the haircut. But, yeah.
I would like to, okay, well, I never want to punish the victims, and especially when, you know, everybody employed the right technology, MFA, and you did everything. It wasn't because they didn't patch. But if we had to be smart, I think, using this kind of force, which, again, I don't agree, but if we were to do it, target the group and the manager or director that brought this vendor in, that forced this vendor in. I think we have too much. Well, why not?
The call center that used
the call center. But I mean, what ends up happening is, like, we all have marketing teams, and every marketing team is demanding that you get the latest and greatest vendor out there, even though if the vendor hasn't had any security, and you're forced. A lot of us security people are forced to say, okay, fine, I have to accept the risk. But that's the, you know, and then that requester, the buyer of that software, then removes themselves from the responsibility of managing that vendor, right? I think that's where we should go back. Look, you brought in this vendor. You demanded that we bring this vendor into the company. It doesn't end there. Your relationship continues with that vendor. You should be responsible to make sure that, you know, they stay secure, not just the security team, not just the compliance team.
I would agree with that as a general principle. Tracing it back and those decisions back to the original executive that made that decision is hard. I remember back in the Bank of America days, some executive, I forget who it was, made a decision to offload our IT support to HP, and we all rued that day. But the executive that made that decision moved on, got promoted, maybe left, who knows, whatever. It's like, all of us are left holding the bag. So as much as we like for that to happen, or maybe even have clawbacks for bonuses,
you don't have to do that. But even if that executive left, there's a new executive. Now you have this whole, you don't just get to start clean, Mr. New Executive or Leader. You have a whole team that you inherit. You have a whole products and companies you're using. It's your responsibility now to take care of that, to make sure that they're being good stewards.
Yeah. I agree. But in this particular case, the question is that given the nature of how stunningly easy this attack is a 15% haircut commensurate, right? Is the punishment and the infraction equal? And I would say in this particular case, it's just the fact that it's so, one, it was a novel type of attack, and two, people did believe that this device flow can be abused, and here you go, seeing it abused. But the reality is that this was a Salesforce feature. It's a feature that Salesforce had, and we tell everyone, don't share codes. But here's somebody sharing a code to you to say, hey, this is something that you can plug into this thing, and it seems innocuous, and you don't notice anything after you do it. And just don't, and it's so hard, it's so easy to get tricked. And so this particular case is one where should they have gotten a 15% cut for this type of attack? I would say no, because of how easy the attack is to execute and because of its novelty.
Yeah, what I would say is that a hedge fund manager, when there's a macroeconomic issue and they have an off year, they don't get paid, and it's not their fault, but like that's what they sign up for, and they're going to try to manage through different storms and whatnot. But there are things that are outside of their control, and they get penalized for them. The good part about that is that it does make them find and beat to death any possible control they might be able to exert, right? They're always trying to exhaust all the ways, and sometimes they just don't have it, but they still lose a little bit. And this just makes me like the CEO and all the way and the CISO and the security engineers and the SOC and everybody in between couldn't have done much about this. That's kind of the point.
Nothing.
I agree with that. But the CEO is going to be paying more attention in the next cyber update. And
sure.
Maybe that's a good outcome. And if I could almost imagine, like, you know, security comp at some point being, you know, very heavily weighted by specific outcome-based comp, right? And, oh, man, it sucks that we had this issue regardless of the provenance of it because I'm not getting paid this year. But maybe I get paid more in the other years, and it's kind of like insurance at that point.
Yeah, so, I guess the challenge is, though, again, great. I agree. I think having some sort of penalty is still warranted, but it has to be commensurate. And the question I would have is, if for the amount that was taken out, there's now a scurry of activity to say, okay, how do we prevent this? Only to realize, wow, this was what could we have done?
You know, I sometimes, you know, I hate surprise here. Security people don't have views into every event that's happening in our company or our vendors. We don't. We try as much as we can. There's just too much information out there. And there are just so many errors that happen that no matter what program you employ, they're all going to sooner or later fail. But we are asked to hold that responsibility. Sometimes I think of us as kind of one of the seers that the kings of yesteryear would hire to tell me what my future looks like. Am I going to win that battle?
Yeah,
and here's me, poor security guy, going, well, Mr. King, I think you have a good chance of winning, but you have a bad chance of also, you have a good chance of losing as well. And if the king lost, they decapitate you. There's a security guy. So, you know, in reality, we don't have a lot of controls, unfortunately, as CISOs. And I hate to say that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, looking at the Qantas incident in particular, where the vendor was a call center in this case, to me, man, I hope we don't miss out the opportunity here to fix TPRM, or at least to have a lens through which to evaluate TPRM. So if you could wind back the clock and say, what could we have done? What could Qantas have done in third-party risk management to avoid this from happening? The answer was not more questions in the Excel spreadsheet that was emailed over, not making them promise that developers don't have access to prod, because we just talked earlier about how we know that's a lie. Like everything that's in the SIG and the SIG Lite and the CAIQ and everything I've ever seen is basically useless in general, and also specifically towards this, right? I mean, at best, you would say, do you background check your employees? And they're going to say yes, no matter what. And who knows what that means? And that doesn't help here. And it's super expensive, like this whole TPRM circus that we run. What would have worked here was smart people being in the room and saying, hey, we're about to bring on this company that's based in Manila. They're going to be handling most of our calls. Oh, why are you bringing that to the security committee? Oh, they're going to all need access and logins into our CRM. Whoa, hold on. Must they? Yeah, they must. Oh, okay. Well, what could go wrong? Well, if somebody siphoned out all the data from the CRM, not only would that be a bad day, but it's happening a lot in the wild. Threat Intel says that. This is hot. It's live. It could happen. Let's fire the entire questionnaire department and reallocate those resources into solving that problem. And then they would say, well, what kind of controls can help with that? Well, you know, let's make sure that the individuals have minimal access. Let's make sure that they can only query 20 records a minute, a day, an hour. When I say that, most people in the TPRM circus, are you crazy? That'd be hard. That would require some code. This is millions of dollars that we're wasting on this TPRM merry-go-round. Let's do these things. You know, go to Salesforce, say, hey, I'm about to bring on a call center. We want you to throttle them to X. We could solve these things if we're specific. All right. Well, it was another fun one, guys. We got all over the place. Thanks a lot for jumping in. I'm looking forward to the next one already. With any luck in the world, if Sunil's right about Apple, we won't have anything to talk about. Because the security is now solved and it's over. All right, guys. I hope you have a great couple of weeks, and I look forward to talking to you soon.